Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
Naval Base Kitsap Bangor has what may be the highest concentration of nuclear weapons at any one site in the country, according to the Federation of American Scientists. And next door in Paulsbo, there's a group of activists called Ground Zero who don't want you to forget it. One of them is Tom Rogers.
A lot of times we will symbolically close the base by blocking the road. Some folks may choose to trespass on federal property by crossing what we call the blue line, which demarks the boundary between federal property and county property. There'll probably be a dozen state patrol officers on the county side of the blue line, and there'll be a dozen Navy security officers on the Navy side of the blue line, and then we sing some songs, and some folks may get arrested, and then we go back and talk about it, and that's a day.
I like how getting arrested is just one little item on the agenda just after the song session.
It is. And people will choose to risk arrest. And that's an important part of what we do because it puts us into the court system where we get another chance to talk about our motivation for being there.
Oh, so you see the arrest and your court appearances as another place to make your case?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So have you been arrested yourself?
I have. Oh, I don't know, 4 times maybe.
What's it like? Do you get, the zip ties around your wrists and stuff like that?
No. The normal arrest is to be taken over to a squad car, essentially issued a citation, and then being escorted back across the road back to our group. It's pretty painless, and then we get a court date.
So where did you come to this from? What was your background before you joined up with Ground Zero?
I was a Navy captain.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about war and peace and all the areas in between. That's all ahead here on KNKX. We get back now to Tom Rogers. He's the guy who, before he was an anti-nuclear crusader, was a career Navy officer.
Most of my career was in attack submarines, which do not carry ballistic missiles. But I did have one tour on a ballistic missile submarine in the Cold War in the 70s. I was just a kid then. But after that, I went to attack submarines. I kind of like the action there a little better.
What was your thinking like around nuclear weapons early on in your career?
I was, like most of the guys, really too busy to think about it very much. The weapons, the drills, we do that stuff all the time, but it's all play. And you just don't think about the consequences of a real war. I was doing my job. And I didn't connect it with a horrific picture of the aftermath of a nuclear war.
So how did your consciousness around it evolve?
Following the Cold War, I expected us to stand down from the Cold War posture that we had been in for essentially 40 years and to start to disarm. And that didn't happen. And then a few years later, I saw that we were beginning to modernize the weapon systems on the earliest Tridents. And I said, why are we doing this? It made me angry. It kind of betrayed my trust in my government to do the right thing. That's what brought me to Ground Zero, was my awareness that that was going on and the fact that, I didn't like it.
So when you first got involved with Ground Zero, how did you kind of get acclimated? I mean, did somebody have to sort of show you the ropes, or how did that work?
When I got there, I met a lot of really welcoming people. And one of the folks that standed out was a nun. Her name was Jackie Hudson. She was a Dominican nun, retired. She was kind of everybody's mom and had been in the movement for a long time. And one of the things that she taught us was that everybody has a sense of comfort. All we can ask is for individuals to take one step out of their comfort zone. You know, that one step to cross into the road, that one step to cross the blue line, that one step to handle out a leaflet or to speak in public. That's what it takes. And today, this interview is out of my comfort zone. And I think about Jackie, and she's passed on now. But I think about Jackie, and I say, yeah, I can take a step out of my comfort zone.
So you're a guy who's gone and gotten yourself arrested 4 times for what you believe in, and it's the interview that's out of your comfort zone?
Well, there you are.
Do you find that there is a kind of cultural disconnect just because of your different background? You didn't grow up as a lifelong hippie. You were a military guy, and you're hanging out with a lot of people who probably were out in the streets when you were on a submarine.
That's funny, because I was a hippie in the mid-60s, and I dropped out of college, and I got drafted, and I joined the Navy to dodge the draft. And then kind of found out that I was good at it, and 32 years later, I got out and became a hippie again. I mean, you know, I had them fooled all those years.
How does your current work and your beliefs go over with military friends?
I have several military friends, and there's no animosity. I feel a sense of respect. I have former military friends that like to go to court every time I'm there and listen to me talk. I have a friend who is a retired admiral who shakes his head and says, I don't know why they're doing that, and I respect, you know, what you're doing to try to stop it. I really, really, really enjoyed being a naval officer. It was, in my mind, a difficult, worthwhile profession. There's a lot of team in the military. Got me up in the morning, and it really felt good. Going to Ground Zero is not dissimilar to that. I'm working with really smart, committed people with a common goal, and last Sunday, I spent 8 hours at Ground Zero and came home smiling. So there are a lot of parallels, and it's not black and white.
What do you think you can accomplish with the kind of direct actions that Ground Zero does?
We had a meeting last Sunday, and one of the things that hit home with me was that my job as an activist is to alert, educate, inspire, and involve the general public in my issue. And I can do that by speaking out. But I've got to be able to make ordinary people think about how nuclear weapons is impacting their lives. Yeah, it's a hard thing to do sometimes, because one of the things that the Navy has done very well is to make nuclear weapons invisible. There was a symposium in March that had a bunch of admirals, and one of the admirals, his name is Rear Admiral Richards, he's the undersea warfare guru in the Pentagon, said that we have essentially removed opposition of nuclear weapons from the American psyche. And I thought that was pretty arrogant, but he believes that. He believes that Americans don't think about nuclear weapons. And I think he's right.
And what do you think when you hear that?
It just motivates me to work harder to do what I do.
Well, Tom Rogers is a career naval officer and now an anti-nuclear activist with the group Ground Zero based in Paulsbo. Tom, thank you so much for coming and talking to us on Sound Effect.
You're welcome, Gabriel.
This is Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our show today is about war and peace. Vanessa Davids comes from an Army family. Her brother, her dad, and her grandfather, they were all in the Army. But she had never expressed much interest. She was a natural resources major at Washington State University. So it was a bit of a shock when, after college, she enlisted. And not only that, she joined the Marine Corps the year after the U.S. invaded Iraq.
I figured that joining the military at that time, it was pretty much guaranteed that I was going to deploy. And so if I was going to go over there, I wanted to be able to talk to the people that I was going to be in country with. And so I wanted to learn Arabic.
Vanessa David spent 5 years in the Marines as an Arabic language translator. And in 2007, she deployed to Alhambra province. And there, even though she did most of her work on base behind the wire, she got a glimpse into the mindset of the enemy that few Americans ever will.
I worked 7 days a week, 12, 15-hour days, doing translation work. And we were doing threat warning reporting for the units in our area.
So people were intercepting like radio communications and stuff like that, and you were translating the recordings?
A variety of media, yes. If it can be recorded, that was something that we could capture and look for intelligence.
Did you also have to wade through a bunch of really mundane stuff?
Yes. There is the mundane where, you know, they're talking about market prices. They're talking about the temperature, whether they have gas for their generators, the wives complaining to their sister about their husbands, or idle chit-chat.
And when you would get to an important recording, a recording that had intelligence value or some kind of tactical value, can you talk about what that was like?
So you could usually tell something bad was probably going to be discussed because people would lower their voices and whisper. For example, they start talking about really quietly about fruit, like pomegranates. Yeah, you know, and where are you putting the pomegranates? And I'll be there to pick up the pomegranates at, you know, 7 o'clock tonight, and don't let anybody see you pick them up. And you knew immediately pomegranates might be a code word for either grenades or some kind of explosive device.
So besides those kinds of operations that you're trying to get wind of, what other kinds of important communications would you wind up translating?
We translated some very challenging material as well that I hadn't expected. I hadn't really expected the video component. We would do things to look at ransom videos, kidnapping videos. We also dealt with the less pleasant beheadings, torture, child pornography, that sort of thing as well. I would say that was my most challenging work, emotionally.
Having to look at that stuff and at least, you know, listen carefully enough to translate it accurately, what was that like for you?
I have very specific memories of that time, things that still bother me today. I went from thinking that the world was like this really good place and there's a few bad things happen, but, you know, bad is bad and it happens over in this other place, to really having a darker view of the world for a long time.
Well, plus being a translator, it seems like it's a really unique position to be in. I mean, you're almost inhabiting the words of the people who are speaking. And if they're doing something awful, like that's a weirdly intimate kind of thing, right?
It is intimate. There are certain words that you're trying to translate and it doesn't necessarily mean it's a literal translation of the word. And you come across this word and you're like, how is it being used in this context? And then that realization will hit you and you go, oh God, that's horrific.
You also must have to put yourself in their shoes a little bit to understand what they mean when they say certain things.
Yeah. Context is everything. You have to be thinking the way that the person is thinking. And that having to label children in pornographic terms was one of the hardest things, I would say, for me.
I can imagine. What was it like as you wound your deployment down and then got out of the military?
It was challenging coming home because at the time I was married. My spouse was also in the Marine Corps. We'd had back-to-back deployments, and so we hadn't seen each other in so long. And going home to see him for a month after almost a year and a half of no contact, I was very nervous.
Did you find that you were different people when you guys got back together?
We were both very different people. His deployment had been extremely challenging. So coming back, he didn't want me to talk about my deployment at all. He had no ears or time for that. It was isolating, very isolating. I only had one person that I really felt that I could talk to, and it was the woman that I'd worked beside, a fellow Marine.
How did you cope then?
I was very angry and withdrawn.
So besides what you were dealing with at home, do you feel like you had a very different experience as a female veteran from the men?
I do. On our small camp, there are maybe a half dozen women total. Everywhere you went, you were an extreme minority. You were stared at. We used to joke that when you'd walk into the chow hall, it was like the scene in Finding Nemo where all the seagulls look and say, mine, 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 because everybody would turn and stare at you because you're the only woman there. And so you're dealing with all of this violent graphic material. You're constantly being stared at, and you don't have anybody to relate to. Even my fellow women that I worked with, we ended up isolating ourselves to a certain degree. There was so much to deal with, and you kind of needed to insulate yourself to protect yourself.
And what about when you were back stateside? Do you think being a female veteran is very different after a deployment?
It is. You come back and you go to the bars and people are like, oh, you just came back from a deployment. That's awesome. And they're getting their drink spot and they're being congratulated and, hey, you did great. And for me, you can't tell that I'm a veteran. I don't have a shaved head. I don't stand out. We are usually thought of as the girlfriends or wives.
How did you feel when somebody would mistake you for...
Pissed off. Very pissed off. Because... especially coming back from that kind of work. It's not that I wanted to be, you know, congratulated. I just wanted to be respected like my peers. And the other thing on base, our experiences were often downplayed. I would try and talk to other male Marines about what I'd done and what I'd gone through, and it was always dismissed. Oh, it couldn't be as hard as you're saying it was. At least you didn't get blown up. And I'd say, yeah, that's very true. And I didn't have that happen, and I'm so grateful. But the work that I did was still very challenging.
Do you still do Arabic language translation?
I do not. I have no desire to do it. I do keep Arabic news on my phone, so I'll read the news or the headlines in Arabic occasionally, but I can't do that kind of work anymore. And I'm afraid of the person that I would become if I did that kind of work.
So you talked about, particularly right after you got back, feeling pretty angry and
yes,
maybe resentful. How have your feelings evolved over the years since then?
It took several years to get beyond the anger, I would say. I used to joke, well, not really joke, and say, just turn it into a glass parking lot, because I don't feel like anything we did there accomplished anything. Just nuke it, lay it flat. I was angry at the whole region. I'd lost friends there. I'd watched my then husband change into a person that I hardly recognized. And I was angry. It actually took therapy and it took some medication before I was able to come out of that dark hole.
Where are you at now with it?
I'm good. I'm able to look back on it and say, you know, that was a very formative time period for me. I've had people say, oh, if you could do it over, would you do it over? And I'd say, yeah, knowing what I know, I'd still go back and do it again. Even the dark period afterwards, I think it had value. I'm much more grateful for beauty and for peaceful things in my life.
What's an example of something that you appreciate or really savor now?
I really savor the innocence of my children. I have two kids, a 5-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy. And I look at their complete innocence of the world, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, Vanessa Davids is a writer and a Marine Corps veteran, and she joined us from Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much for talking with us, Vanessa.
Thank you. I'm glad to have the time to talk about it. It's not something that I talk about very much at all, actually. So to be able to speak about it is It's refreshing. Thank you. I'll probably go into my car and cry a little bit. That's okay, too. It was just to have somebody ask. Sorry.
It really means so much to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our show today is about war and peace. And now a story of how war makes ordinary people do extraordinary things. For this, we go back in time to World War II and across the world to southern Norway. There in the midst of a frozen wilderness on the edge of an icy cliff sits a hydroelectric plant called Vermok. And deep within this hulking fortress was a factory within a factory. And that made a rare substance that was crucial to Adolf Hitler's most diabolical fantasies. That plant manufactured something called heavy water, and it was a key ingredient for an atomic bomb. The Allies figured that if Hitler got his hands on this stuff, the Germans could win the war. So they wanted to destroy the plant, and their first plan was to bomb it to smithereens. But a Norwegian named Leif Tronstad, who helped design the plant, he knew better.
Tronstad said, well, you're going to have a very hard time hitting this plant. It's in this very deep valley that the sun rarely shines upon. And second of the matter is, this fortress is tens of thousands of pounds of steel and stone. And the heavy water plant, the most important part of it, is in the basement. So you can lob bombs at this thing all day, and you have a small chance of actually destroying it.
That's Seattle author Neil Bascom, who wrote about the history of Vermok in his new book, The Winter Fortress. And he says Leif Tronstad, who was a scientist, not a military guy, spearheaded a new sabotage plan.
So the Allies decided that they want to send a larger team of British sappers in to bomb the plant.
And British sappers, there's like British special forces
British,
kind of?
British Royal Engineers, British commandos. But these guys can't just drop into Norway. They need guides. And so the British decided they're going to send a four-man team of Norwegians, a team called Operation Grouse, to land into Norway a month before this assault, prepare intelligence, and be on hand to lead them to the plant.
So you have these four guys that parachuted in on their own to lay the groundwork, and then they were going to send in the cavalry.
Exactly. And these four individuals, three of them were from the town. So they knew that area like the back of their hand.
So they make it in. And what happens to the cavalry?
The cavalry comes in by glider. Technology malfunction, bad weather, disaster. One of the planes crashes. Some of the sappers get captured. The Gestapo brings them in, tortures them, and then kills them. And by the end of the torture and the interrogation, the Gestapo knows the plans for the attack on Vermok.
So how is that not the end of your book?
Well, simultaneously with the crash, Leif Tronstad and Colonel Wilson decide the Allies still need to hit this plant. The best way to do it is a small Norwegian commando team. Thus, the start of Operation Gunnerside.
So Operation Gunnerside. So those are more Norwegian commandos who are going to join up with those first four, the Operation Grouse team, and they were going to do it super stealth style, much more precision than the big British team.
Exactly. You have the six men of Operation Gunnerside. They're trained on a mock heavy water plant that Leif Tronstad builds for them. And Tronstad tells them every door, every stairwell, every access point to the plant. They are parachuted in to meet up with Operation Grouse. Together, they hit the plant.
So what was life like for the Grouse team then in the months that ensued as they waited for the plan to come back together in its new form?
Well, Grouse lived for essentially the next 3 months on their own, in this wilderness plateau, suffering blizzard after blizzard in a place that got so cold, legend had it, that flames froze in the fire so quickly. And if they'd not been able to hunt for reindeer, they would have died. So Gunnerside is going to pair up with Grouse, which eventually happens after a 14-day blizzard that almost killed all of them. And on the night of February 27th, they make their approach to the plant.
And how do they do that?
Well, as I mentioned, this winter fortress is on the side of a cliff. Well, this Gunnerside team decides that that our best chance is to climb up this cliffside, this 500-foot cliffside, in the middle of the night in February without any lights or any sort, and reach a railway line which runs along the cliffside to the neighboring town. Sounds perfectly reasonable, doesn't it?
I guess if you're a bunch of commandos.
No, exactly. If you're Norwegian commandos. I mean, even the local boys, they initially said, well, there's no way. They were told as children, do not climb this cliffside.
So what happens?
They climb up the cliffside, and they slip in, two parties. All the doors that they thought would be open are now closed. So suddenly they're, in some senses, not freaking out, but they're concerned, how are we going to get into this plant? Thankfully, Tronstadt, the individual who built the plant, said, well, there's this little channel of cables and pipes that you can climb up and into and shimmy your way through to get into the basement level.
They claw their way through this tunnel, and then they finally emerge into the belly of the beast, the heart of the winter fortress. Can you describe what they find there, what they see?
So the heart of the winter fortress, curiously, is unguarded, because the Germans never thought that anyone could possibly get through the minefields, through the barbed wire fences, through the searchlights, through all the security that they had set up. And so the basement level is essentially what you would find in a factory, tall ceilings, sounds of the hydroelectric plant in the distance, and these 18 cylinders creating heavy water. There was a single foreman who was Norwegian watching over the heavy water plant, but that was it.
And so they finally set all these charges. They get their fuses out. They're ready to light them. And then in this surreal moment, you write about the foreman there saying, hey, wait a minute, where's my glasses?
It's a wonderful little moment in this story because it's a very human moment, right? This guy suddenly, who's watching this plant, realizes he can't find his glasses, needs help. And Ronenberg takes time off to search for these glasses for this individual, hands them back to them, and then proceeds with the operation. Set the explosives, and boom.
So how likely did it seem that they were going to get out of there alive?
Unlikely, at best. They all had suicide pills. They had the suspicion that they could get in. Maybe one of them would still be alive to blow up the plant. Getting out was a totally different kind of thing. And what's awesome is they were able to get out and then escape this massive manhunt over the next few months.
On skis.
On skis. A lot of this story happens on skis. A great majority of it.
Is that why it was so important to Tronstadt to get Norwegians to do this?
It was. They need to be able to survive in this environment. They need to know how to build a snow cave on an instant's notice. They need to know how to hunt reindeer. And the only people who they thought they could do that was Norwegians.
Wow. So they managed to blow the thing up. What difference do you think that this made, ultimately, in the Nazi atomic bomb project?
Well, if you take together all the operations, gunner side, the American bombing that comes afterwards, and then a final sabotage mission of a transport of heavy water, it essentially stopped the Germans from having the heavy water they needed to create their nuclear research.
So you can see how this would be a big priority for the Allies and for the British government. But it must have taken extraordinary motivation from the saboteurs themselves. I mean, these men who persevered through so much and assumed that they were probably going to get themselves killed in the process. What motivated them, and how do you know?
I mean, Leif Tronstadt knew, of course, atomic bomb, this is what we're stopping. Most of the other commandos had no idea what they were doing. They were told the Germans might use it to create an explosive that could blow up London, but they largely discounted that. I mean, these were—
They didn't believe it, you mean?
They didn't believe it. And they say they didn't believe it. They thought that Tronstadt and the SOE was just selling them the importance of this mission so that they would take it seriously. But they didn't need to be sold. These guys were doing it out of patriotism, out of freedom for Norway, and atomic bombs and everything else were secondary at best. It's all about this town, this moment, your family.
Well, Neil Bascom is a Seattle-based author, and his book is called Winter's Fortress, The Epic Mission to Sabotage Hitler's Atomic Bomb. You can also find the young adult version, which is called simply Sabotage. Neil, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
This is Sound Effect from 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories of war and peace. Pretty soon after Iraqi surgeon Fareed Alani finished medical school, he found himself practicing combat medicine. This was in the 1980s, and Iraq was in a bloody war with Iran. After it wound down, Alani went to work in a regular hospital doing orthopedic surgery. But with Iraq entangled in a string of conflicts, he never really stopped dealing with the aftermath of violence. Still, he was able to keep some distance from it, at least for a while. Alani lives in the Seattle area now. He explained how he wound up here, beginning with what it was like to practice medicine in Iraq in the years after the U.S. invasion.
In the beginning, there was every week two or three explosions, and when you go early in the morning to the hospital, you will face a lot of people who needs your help. When you see a lot of people who are wounded severely, or you see bodies of dead people, for sure you will feel something abnormal and you will say, why is this happening? And what's the end of this?
Dealing day in and day out with the results of this violence and the danger that you must have been living in, did you feel fear for yourself, for your own safety?
Well, not so much, because we were safe inside the hospital. So at that time, we only think about our patients.
Yeah, but that changed, right?
For sure, it did change. One day when I was leaving my clinic at night, I usually go back to my home by my car. And at that day, I remember very well, I cannot forget it, that two cars were following me. One stood in front of my car and one at the back. And they dropped me out of the car and they beat me a lot. They took me in one of their cars. They tied my eyes, they tied my legs and hands. After a while of driving the car, they dropped me in a house. And they kept me tight eyes and hands and legs for about 3 days.
That must have been the loneliest feeling there.
Yeah, it is lonely. But, you know, I think when you feel in fear, loneliness disappears. Fear is more severe, I think, than to feel lonely.
Yeah.
Because they can't do anything anytime, and you should expect that they do anything. Sometimes I hear them using their weapon,
their gun.
Yeah, and I was
like cleaning it or doing something like that.
Yeah, like that, and I expect anytime one bullet will come directly to my head.
Wow.
And the way that they behave and let me hear these sounds, it's a way of threatening.
Did they yell at you? Did they ask you questions? Like, what were their interactions with you like?
For sure, they yelled, especially when they tried to pull me out of my car. And then they beat me many times, and they pulled me by force and put me in the car. When we reached to the house, where they put me, yeah, they interrogated me completely, and they talked about how much money do I have at home and how much money do I have at the bank. And every now and then they come and talk to me and leave me alone, threatening me in a way or another. Well, let me tell you, one day he asked me that, why your shoulder sometimes hurts you? I told him, possibly you may lift something heavy. As an orthopedic, I thought that he was asking me like that.
So he was asking you for medical advice?
No, really, he was threatening me in another way, but I thought it like he is asking for a medical advice. Then he proceeded and told me that, well, I'm asking you, if you use your gun for 5 times a day, killing others, would this hurt your shoulder or not?
Ooh.
So I told him, for sure it will. He's threatening me that he can kill me. I would be one of those 5, if he like.
Yeah, that's just chilling.
Yeah, it's not easy.
What did they want?
For sure, they were asking for money.
So they wanted a ransom from your family.
They took a ransom from my mother.
Yeah. Do you know who they were?
For sure, no. Nobody knows.
But they knew who you were.
for sure, they know everything about me. They told me all the story of my life. They told me that you work in this area and you work in this hospital and you gain a lot, this amount of money, your house in this area and your daughter's at that school. And this is the main thing that made me careful.
Yeah, what when they brought up your children and said that they knew what school they went to, what did you think?
The only thing that I thought at that time is that they are going to kidnap them. And I can't help them in that moment. And when I knew that they are talking about my daughters, I don't know. I was, as you say, hopeless. How can I help them? How can I prevent this? It's a bad, very bad feeling. It is more bad than what I have suffered at that time.
That fear, yeah. So I know kidnappings are not uncommon in Iraq, and there's a whole industry around kidnappings and demanding ransoms. Did you imagine that you would be released and that this is part of living in Iraq, or did you fear worse?
No. The usual thing that was passing that after they get the ransom, they will kill the kidnapped person. Yeah. Fortunately, I returned to my family.
Yes, and what was that like to be released and to rejoin your family?
It's a mixed sensation. You feel happy. Again, you feel insecure because this has happened. Possibly it will happen again for me or for my brothers or for my daughters. It is not anymore secure to live in Iraq.
Do you feel that that changed you?
Somehow, yes.
So what did you and your family decide to do?
They asked me to leave.
Your family asked you that? Yeah.
Yeah, because they said your life is more precious than anything. It's true that I have my career there. I have my fame. I worked hardly during these many years. I was a very successful surgeon there. I gained a lot of money. And I had my home, my car, my memories, my friends, my everything that one could dream in. But you have to leave it away because your life and the life of your family members is the most important thing.
How was it when you first arrived, adjusting to it, and how was it for your family also?
Yeah, fortunately, we have some people here. We don't know them, but they are working for us.
The International Rescue
Committee. Yeah, International yeah. Rescue Committee. They received us at the airport, and they travel us with cars into our an apartment. Then after a while, not more than a few minutes, they told us that we are leaving you today just to have rest and we'll come to see you tomorrow. And they handed me the keys of the apartment and they told me, this is your apartment. Now get rest and tomorrow we'll talk. When we got to inside the rooms and we see that they have prepared everything, it's amazing. Yeah? There are people who are working for your rest. Yeah, and they don't know even your name. We felt at that time we have reached a different culture, or let us say different environment, peaceful and helpful and friendly.
Yeah, can you say more about what it's like to experience somewhere where you feel safe enough to rest? After you've been in a place where you just must be on your toes constantly.
When I was there in my home country, when I leave my home to the clinic, my wife calls me twice or thrice. When I leave, I phone her and call her. I have reached to this point, so she would be calm. When my daughter goes to school in Iraq, we usually drive them to the school, and sometimes we wait for them until they finish because we are not sure that they will come alone safely. Well, here in the United States, it is about 4 o'clock now, and I left them at 8 o'clock from morning. And I haven't called them because I feel they are safe, and they feel they are safe. Sometimes memories of the war in Iraq or the conflict in Iraq and the process of kidnapping and endangering my family sometimes comes to my mind. But, you know, since I came to the United States, I feel safe. I feel comfortable completely. Not only me, my wife, and my two daughters.
Well, Dr. Fareed Alani was an orthopedic surgeon in Baghdad, in Iraq, and resettled to Seattle in December, where he's been ever since and works with the International Rescue Committee here. Well, thank you so much, Fareed.
Thank you very much. You're welcome anytime.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is War and Peace. And when you think of the peace movement in this country, I for one think about folk music. Dylan, Pete Seeger. But the guy who set the template for a lot of that anti-war music was Woody Guthrie. His peace songs and anti-fascist songs would inspire generations of musicians and activists. But before World War II, Guthrie was already cranking out political music and songs meant to uplift the downtrodden in America's Dust Bowl. That caught the attention of all people, the Bonneville Power Administration. The agency brought him to the Pacific Northwest to write songs about the construction of the Grand Coulee Dam. During a four-week period in the spring of 1941, Guthrie wandered between Washington and Oregon and wrote dozens of songs. Greg Vandy wrote a book about this period called 26 Songs in 30 Days. He hosts the radio show The Roadhouse on Seattle station KEXP. He's a roots music guy, but even he was surprised when he discovered this local chapter in Guthrie's story.
What they wanted him to do was to write songs for a promotional film called The Columbia. This was a documentary film that would sort of educate the local citizens in the Northwest about the benefits of the public works projects.
A century and a half ago, Thomas Jefferson envisioned an empire of freedom and opportunity in the far Northwest.
Grand Coulee Dam and the Bonneville Dam, and how these were going to really dramatically affect and change people's life for the better, particularly rural people and farmers. So Woody was hired as a month-long commissioned songwriter, and that was the song cycle. He was commissioned to write a song a day for 1 month.
There's a great and peaceful river in a land that's fair to see, where the Douglas fir tree whispers to the snow-capped mountain breeze. Where the cliffs are solid granite and the valley's always green, this is just as close to heaven as my traveling feet have been. Roll, Columbia, won't you roll, roll, roll.
I do a radio show about American music, and so I'm trying to share with my audience music maybe they haven't heard of, especially in terms of American roots music, because even though everyone knows sort of that, what that means, as traditional forms in our heritage music, not many people really know that much about it. They don't go too deep with that. So when I discovered the story of Woody Guthrie writing songs about our backyard, the Columbia Basin, and was hired by the BPA in Portland and wrote really about our locality, yeah, that's a great story.
I'm just the lonesome traveler, the great historical bum. Highly educated, from history I have come. I built the Rock of Ages, was in the year of one. And that was about the biggest thing that man had ever done.
What happened was he was living in California, really at a very low point with no prospects for a job, and he needed a job. Like most everyone suffering from the Depression, he was looking for a gig. Stephen Kahn was an employee of the Bonneville Power Administration. He hired Woody Guthrie and gave him the framework necessary and the discipline necessary and, the materials, and a driver named Elmer Bueller. And he was shown around the Columbia Basin, and Stephen Kahn demanded a song a day. He said he needed to turn in a song. He described it much like a screenwriter in Hollywood back in the day who, had to turn in a certain amount of pages per day, whether they were good or bad.
It's a mighty hard road that my poor hand has hold. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot and your mountains was cold.
Pastures of Plenty is the ultimate migrant song. It's about the lifestyle of migrants, of going from one place to the other, looking for work, looking for a way to scratch out a living and to survive with a family, and then to come to the Columbia Basin, and after irrigation, being able to start up your own life again as a small family farmer.
Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that Grand Coulee Dam where the water runs down. Ever stayed in this union, us migrants have been. We work in this fight, and we'll fight till we win.
Well, it's all. Woody was perfect for the job because he firsthand knew the struggles of being a Dust Bowl migrant, and the idea of this this rhetoric of the planned promised land, which they dubbed the Columbia Basin after irrigation, right? So it went from a dry desert, useless land, to being irrigated from the water from the Grand Coulee Dam, that this would be sort of a solution to the Dust Bowl crisis.
Well, the world has seven wonders that travelers always tell. Some gardens and some flowers, I guess you know them well. But now the greatest wonder in Uncle Sam's fair land is the King Columbia River and the big Grand Coulee Dam.
So when you have all of the Columbia River songs together in a song cycle of 26 songs, and of course only 17 of these 26 songs were recorded, then you really sort of understand the beauty of his simplicity, and the beauty of his message, which was not a complicated one. It was about the benefits of the projects and the beauty of the landscape and what it was like as a Dust Bowler to see this area and what promise it had for his people. Really an amazing story about, you know, America's greatest folk icon and the biggest thing that man has ever done converging, you know, at the same time. And so it's pretty amazing that that the story takes place, you know, in where we live, you know. Who knew?
From the Rocky Canyon where the Columbia River rolls, seen the salmon leaping, the rapids and the falls, the big Grand Coulee Dam in the state of Washington. Just about the biggest thing that man has ever done.
Greg Vandy is the author of 26 Songs in 30 Days, Woody Guthrie and the Columbia River Project. That story was produced by Florangela Davila. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing. We got help this week from Ali Ferguson, Florangela Davila, and Ginny Palmer. Also, a very special thank you to producer Shane Maley, who has been an enormous help for this show for the last 3 months. Parker Miles Blom helps with photos and videos, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. This episode and many, many more are available for the cost of nothing. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, or if you find us on iTunes, you can rate and review the show. You can also send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org or find us on Facebook. Tune in next week when we head down the rabbit hole. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.